Secondly, as with all, at least my classes now with PowerPoint, now that I'm into that, I have copies of all of the slides, the PowerPoint, so you don't need to take notes while we're going through it. I don't want to give it to you in advance, lest you be distracted, but there are copies for everyone up here at the conclusion. So I totally forgot, I wanted to bring a couple bottles of vodka for tonight. And I was going to, instead of giving out the water, I was going to give everyone a little l'chaim. So how could you come... I forgot, I've been rushing all day, I haven't been home. How could you come together to study Tanya and not have a l'chaim and not have some vodka? But we're going to have to try. We're going to have to try nonetheless. Is it okay if I take my jacket off?
Please.
Someone please remind me where I put it. Okay. So I'm really excited about this topic. It happens to be that the last couple of years I've tried to make my way through Tanya. I can't say I've been through all of it, but a fair amount of it. So when I had the opportunity to, when Rabbi Moskowitz slotted me in to be teaching Tanya as part of our People of the Book, I was all too excited and prepared for the last few days and really learned so much and so excited to share it together with you. So here we have a picture of the Bala Tanya, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. That's his Likutei Amarim Tanya, and that's what we're going to study tonight. Who is Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi? So I'll tell you what our style. I think part of the beauty of this course, of the People of the Book, is that each of the teachers have their own style. Each of the teachers brings their own methodology. So I think some probably go more text-based into it. What I like to try to provide, the way I see my obligation or my mandate, is so that everyone leaves this room tonight with a context. Who wrote the Tanya? When did he live? Why did he write the Tanya? Who was his intended audience for the Tanya? And what are the overall themes of the Tanya? And it's the fact that you can't quote chapter and verse, that's because you have to learn the Tanya. In an hour and a half, nobody can spoon-feed you the actual texts. The purpose of People of the Book, from my perspective, is to provide a context and create an appetite, to whet your appetite so that you will want to purchase copies of these books, create a library of People of the Book. We should sell that. People of the Book library. Mark it up a little bit, put the BRS logo on it. What? That's a good idea. That's what we should be doing. Anyway, so to whet your appetite so that you want. So that's our goal tonight. Who is the Bala Tanya? Who wrote the Tanya? When did he live? Where did he live? Why did he live? What was his audience? What was his goal? What are the themes of the book? So that, again, to me, the purpose of every class of People of the Book is that in 3 years, you're sitting in our shul, hours of someone else's, and you hear the word Kuzari, Rashi, Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, Malbim, Tanya, you're not saying it's something vaguely, you're saying, I know who wrote that, when they lived, and so on and so forth. So that's what we're doing today. Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, that is the author of the Tanya. He's known otherwise as the Baal HaTanya. The term Baal is like Baal HaBayis, Baal Chesed, Baal Tzedaka, Baal HaGola, Baal, lots of things. A Baal means the owner of, the master of. He's the Baal HaTanya because he is the author of, the master of. He is the one who provided us with the Tanya. Who is he? When was he born? The Bala Tanya was born on the 18th of Elul of the year 5505. Translated into the Gregorian calendar, September 14th, 1745. Chai Elul. 18 is the number Chai. And now you have the first hint why Chai Elul is one significant date on the Chabad calendar. We're going to get to a number of other significant dates on the Chabad calendar. But the Bala Tanya is born on Chai Elul. That's his birthday. And therefore it's a significant day. Where is he born? He's born in... Someone help me pronounce this. Liozna? Liozna. White Russia. What today is Belarus. Here is a convenient map of the rise of Hasidism. The arrow conveniently points to Liozna. So that's where he's born, in White Russia, today Belarus, the northeast section of Russia. That's where the Bala Tanya comes into the world. What we're now going to do is leave the Bala Tanya, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. All we did was meet him. He was just born. He's a second old. And we're already going to take a break from the Bala Tanya to understand the context in which he is born. Because if you don't understand the birth of Hasidism, and what came before Hasidism, which is the Shabtai Tzvi, and what comes before Shabtai Tzvi, which is the Arizal and Lurianic Kabbalah, if you don't understand all of that, you can't hope to appreciate who the Bala Tanya is or what the contribution he makes is. So we're going to go on a detour. We're going to come back to the Bala Tanya and study Tanya, but we need to understand where he came from and the world he lived in. And to understand that, we have to take a long trip back to the time of Rav Isaac Luria Ashkenazi, otherwise known as the Arizal, the 16th century. The Arizal, there is his grave. Anyone here been to his grave? Where is he buried? Tzfat. Anyone here been to his mikvah? If so, you're still shivering. It's the coldest place on earth. The Ari's mikvah in Tzfat. If you find a good excuse why you can't go in, go with it, because it is freezing, freezing cold. The Ari lived in Tzfat. That's his kever. He introduces the Sphiros. That's the symbol of the Sphiros, the Kabbalistic grid, so to say. How does he get the name Arizal? He was born, his mother didn't say, little Arizal, come to the dinner table, did you do your homework? She didn't call him Arizal. How did he get the name Arizal? The Aleph of Arizal stands for... No, you'd think that, his last name, but it's a reference as if he's our God, our master, Rebbe Yitzchak. And Zal is Zichrono Levracha. So he can be known as the Ari, our master, Rebbe Yitzchak, or he can be known as Arizal, Zichrono Levracha. The Arizal. He lives in the 16th century, 1534 to 1572. The Arizal is born in Yerushalayim. He is the product of a mixed marriage, of an intermarriage. An Ashkenazi father and a Sephardic mother. So, probably had some mysticism, some Kabbalah in his background. He lived only 38 years. If you did the math, the 1534 to 1572, you realize. Everyone in this room knows the name Arizal. I don't think we study the Arizal in the people of the book. Someone should tell you. Is anyone keeping notes about for next year? Every time I teach, I mention three people we should do next year. The Arizal, everyone knows the name Ari. Everyone knows Tzfat. And that's all before the Kabbalah Center. We know Ari. And yet he only lived 38 short years. Think about what a man accomplished in his life in 38 years. No one goes to Tzfat without visiting the Arizal. No one thinks of Kabbalah, of mysticism, without thinking of the Ari, of the Arizal. In 38 years. Makes me feel pretty small. But in those 38 years, he revolutionized the world with his teachings. Until the Ari, the Zohar. Who's the author of the Zohar? So that's also a good subject for next year's people of the book. The classic understanding, the traditional understanding is that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the great Tana, the great Mishnaic rabbi, taught the, rather composed the Zohar when he went to the cave and lived there those years with his son when they were fleeing the Romans. However, there are modern scholars and there's a great controversy. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai wrote it? Was it written by someone else? It's a great topic for people of the book, part 2. But until the Ari, the Zohar and its esoteric teachings and Jewish mysticism were concealed. Only the elite had access. Zohar is written in a difficult, complex Aramaic, even harder than the Talmud. People who are fluent in the Talmud still struggle to understand the Zohar. And the Zohar is a closed document. It's a closed book. You need a real tradition, you need a teacher. And there were very few, it was the elite mystics who had access to this entire world of Jewish mysticism of Kabbalah. All the way from Shimon Bar Yochai, ostensibly, and the Zohar, until the Ari. What did the Ari do? He personally didn't publish anything. It's another remarkable thing. The Ari and his contribution is incredible. He lived 38 short years and published nothing. But he had a student that we all associate with him, Rav Chaim Vital. Another remarkable thing, Rav Chaim Vital did not study with the Ari for 25 of the 38 years. How long did they even know each other? A whopping total of 2 years. 2 years! Rav Chaim Vital was able to absorb all the teachings of the Ari, and in those 2 years, Rav Chaim Vital records them and produces what we have today is known as the Kisvei HaAri, which is the Ari's teachings. What did he contribute in it? The Arizal reinterprets many ideas in the Zohar and popularizes its study. He introduces what has become known since then. It's kind of a second version of Kabbalah, Lurianic Kabbalah, the Ari's Kabbalah, with a tremendous emphasis on concepts of reincarnation, repair, tikkun, redemption, and messianism. So here the Ari is living in the 16th century, born in Yerushalayim, leaves Israel actually for a short time of his life, lives most of his life and dies in Tzfat, a total of 38 years, but in those 38 years, he provides a window, he provides access
to the world, to that which was hidden, to that which was concealed for centuries before him. And he does so, the window he provides is not to esoteric teachings of the Kabbalah, but he, I don't want to say reinterprets, but he shapes the Kabbalah, he molds mysticism in a way which has great contemporary meaning for those in the 16th century. Concepts that they're desperate for, because what's happening in the Jewish people in the 16th century? What's happening in almost every other century, which is everyone wants to kill us. It's pretty depressing. So you can imagine the idea of reincarnation, of your soul coming back, of the possibility of having a better life next time go around. The concept of tikkun, of repair, that you're going through suffering, but somehow it's repairing. The concept of redemption, this is all part of a chain, a development of redemption. The concept of messianism, these were very, very appealing concepts. And the teachings of the Ari and Luriana Kabbalah spread. His ideas traveled to Italy, Poland, they spread far and wide. But one of the products, one of the results of the Ari, on the very heels of the Ari comes the episode of Shabtai Tzvi. Those who came Shabbos afternoon, this past Shabbos, I taught about Tu B'Shvat. Everyone knows the Tu B'Shvat Seder was introduced by a book called Chemdas Yamim. We don't know the author of Chemdas Yamim, but we know it was published shortly after the time of Shabtai Tzvi. And there's great suspicion. There was an accusation by Rav Yaakov Emden that the Chemdas Yamim was a Sabbatian, was a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. And therefore this great debate is Tu B'Shvat, certainly it's a legitimate authoritative holiday, that's what we discussed at length past Shabbos. But the Tu B'Shvat Seder with its Kabbalah and its teachings, maybe that's all really hidden Shabtai Tzvi agenda. Who was Shabtai Tzvi? I'll get to it in a second, but rabbis begin to ban the study of Kabbalah as a result. In other words, the Arizal opens up Kabbalah for the world. The result is not only Shabtai Tzvi, there are the Frankists, there's a whole movement of false messiahs and distorted Jewish philosophies. Who is Shabtai Tzvi? He lived 1726 to 1676. So the Arizal in the 16th century, and Shabtai Tzvi comes on his heels in the 17th century. Again, remember, you're getting a PowerPoint, a printout of every one of these slides. You have it all. So here's a picture of Shabtai Tzvi. This is actually the insert of a book from the 17th century. Ateret Tzvi. Who do you think that is sitting on the throne? That is Shabtai Tzvi, Melech HaMashiach. What happens? Shabtai Tzvi is a Turkish rabbi. He's born and lives in Turkey. He's a Turkish rabbi and a Kabbalist. He's a student, not directly, but of Lurianic Kabbalah. One of the people now excited to be learning and have access to Kabbalah. 1964, he's put, that should say 1690. Okay, I apparently had too many l'chaims when I was writing this. Okay, I'm sorry about that. 1694, 1664, thank you. 1664, he is proclaimed by Nathan of Gaza, Nasan HaAzati, as the long-awaited Mashiach. He has moved to Israel by this point. He's garnered a following in Israel. Actually, when he was in his early 20s, Shabtai Tzvi already pronounced himself to be Mashiach. But when you're in your early 20s and you say you're Mashiach, no one takes you seriously. So he stood in a soapbox and said, I am Mashiach, in his early 20s, and they said, keep the line moving. But by the time he gets a little bit older, now he's in Israel and he's got a following, and one of his biggest followers is someone from Gaza, Aza, named Nasan, Nathan. Nathan of Gaza proclaimed 1664 that Shabtai Tzvi is the Mashiach. A wave of messianism sweeps not just from Israel, but Eastern Europe, Lithuania, and around. In those 2 years, Nathan is one of his followers who's in Israel, and he really embraces, and he's the one who really proclaims. Here's a little hint if anyone wants to declare themselves Messiah. It works much better when someone else says he's Messiah than when you say I'm Messiah. It's a much better methodology. So that's the gig they got going on here, is that Shabtai Tzvi, Nathan of Gaza, proclaims him to be Mashiach. Those 2 years ravage Jewry. It's hard for us to think, because that was before Twitter and Facebook. That was before Fox and CNN News. It was before New York Times and Wall Street Journal. It was before you could have editorials and blogs and Facebook posts creating a movement. And yet, in 2 short years, tens of thousands became followers of Shabtai Tzvi. Now, what does it tell you about that time and about those people?
Desperation.
They were desperate. They were yearning. They were longing for hope, for optimism. They were desperate for something positive. Someone's Mashiach, a better future? They grab onto it. They grasp it. But what happens? All it takes is 2 years. 1664, sorry again. At the age of 40, he's forced by the Ottoman Sultan Mehmed IV to convert to Islam. 2 years later, this great rabbi and Kabbalist, the Melech HaMashiach sitting on his throne, Ateres Tzvi, 2 years he's already converting to Islam. It spurns a series of false messiahs. And what it does is it introduces a suspicion that lasts for centuries that great rabbis were really Sabbateans. Rav Yaakov Emden, we had Rabbi J.J. Schachter from Yeshiva University who wrote his doctoral dissertation about Rav Yaakov Emden, who's an expert on the Emden-Eibschitz controversy. We could spend 4 hours on that. That's good for next year also. Rav Yaakov Emden is a great subject for people of the book. But Rav Yaakov Emden, Rav Yonason Eibschitz is the head of the three communities of Germany. Anyone who's been to, was at the Jews of Germany class, there's the tri-cities of Germany. And Rav Yaakov Emden is... Rav Yaakov Emden accuses Rav Yonason Eibschitz. Can you imagine? That's like Rabbi Soloveitchik saying, Rav Moshe Feinstein is a Jew for Jesus. That's the equivalent. It's the equivalent of Rav Soloveitchik saying, Rav Moshe Feinstein, he behaves and he carries himself as if he's a traditional Jew, but you should know secretly, he believes in Jews for Jesus. It's at least the equivalent of that. And that's what Rav Yaakov Emden accuses Rav Yonason Eibschitz in the next century, in the 18th century, in the end of the 17th and the early 18th century. To the point, I'll just share this insight that Rabbi J.J. Schachter likes to share. Rav Yaakov Emden had a printing press in his basement. They're living just 150 years after the invention of the printing press, a short time later. Rav Yaakov Emden, for whatever reason, has access. He produces dozens and dozens of books, of pamphlets, that absolutely smear Rav Yonason Eibschitz in ways I would blush to tell you what Rav Yaakov Emden accuses Rav Yonason Eibschitz of. I would blush. And Rabbi J.J. Schachter likes to say, again, he's the expert, the scholar on this, the tragedy for Rav Yaakov Emden's life was that he had that printing press. Because if there was a printing press down the block and he had to sleep on his manuscript and he had to go there and he had to convince the guy to publish it, 99% of it wouldn't have come out. It's the equivalent to us today of email. If we had to write that letter and put it in an envelope and find a stamp and walk to a... we'd have a lot of opportunities to stop before we press send of something that we come to regret. So anyway, for centuries after the Shabtai Tzvi controversy, there are these accusations. There is this horrific devastation that rips through world Jewry over the suspicion for centuries that people continue to be closet Shabtai Tzvi followers. I don't want to, I mean, it's not necessarily appropriate, especially for our topic tonight on the Balatanya, but there's questions today. Dr. David Berger has written extensively about questions about the Lubavitcher Rebbe and the Mashiachists and those who proclaim him to be Mashiach. Are there parallels? Should there be parallel reactions by the Jewish community? Nothing, God forbid, read wrong about the Rebbe, who was an unbelievable tzaddik and Talmud Chacham, and nothing wrong with Chabad. But there are pockets of people who distort our traditional thinking, and the reason some react so, recoil so harshly, like Dr. David Berger and others, is it's reminiscent of Shabtai Tzvi. Chassidus, the birth of Chassidus against this backdrop. In the aftermath of Shabtai Tzvi, controversial Jewish communities are devastated. There's a tremendous split between the scholars and the ignorant. Right, the two sentences, that could have been another bullet. But what's happening now in Europe, in the aftermath, so we're now into the 18th century. In the 18th century, Jewry is broken into a class system. In every community, there are scholars, those that pore over the text, those that sit by candlelight in the Beis Medrash, those that are scholars, and then there are the pious illiterate. They farm, they're blacksmiths, they're tailors, they're shopkeepers, but they're practically illiterate. They may be pious in their observance, but they're illiterate. And there's a growing divide between the two. And there is, the majority are this pious illiterate, with only the very small minority being the scholars. This large majority, the amcha, you might say, who are the pious illiterate, are feeling incredibly disenfranchised from Judaism. They're feeling very disillusioned. They're feeling very cold, because they don't have access, and they're not admired, and they're not put on a pedestal. And there's a growing sentiment that to be loved by God, you have to know Shas by heart. To be loved by God, you have to be someone who's capable, who's a scholar, who can open the Talmud. And the average person who prays sincerely in the morning and goes to work and prays sincerely in the evening and takes tithes of his money and does, but feels like a second-class citizen. And in that environment comes along Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer, known as the Baal Shem. The Baal Shem, the Baal Shem Tov, the acronym, the Besht. He lives in the Ukraine. He becomes known as a healer. He becomes known as a miracle worker. He lives at 1698 to 1760. That's his grave. We have it today. And that's a drawing of it. He was amazingly sincere. And he begins to interact with the Amcha, the Baal Shem Tov. He's healing them. There's amazing, whether they're apocryphal stories, true stories. We have all kinds of tradition of the miracles that he worked and the healer that he was. And whether they're meant to be taken literally or not, what's clear is he was beloved by the masses. He was accessible. He was warm. He was sincere. He cared about them. And he cared about elevating them spiritually. He cared about making them feel loved. He cared about inspiring their brand of Judaism. He taught them that true service of Hashem is not only about learning and scholarship, but it's about faith, emunah, trust, bitachon. It's about sincere love, loving Hashem and feeling His love back. It's about passion in your prayer. He settles in the town of Nesbitch in Ukraine, and from there he spreads Hasidus in a systematic fashion. That's the Baal Shem. Okay, so the Baal Shem, so we had the Arizal, Luriana Kabbalah in the 16th century. In the 17th century, we have the Shabtai Tzvi controversy, and where Kabbalah can go bad, because the concepts of messianism and reincarnation and redemption lead to false messiahs. On the heels of this movement of false messiahs, we have the birth of Hasidus, the Baal Shem. Now, the Baal Shem has many students. I could have had pages and pages and pages of charts of his students, but we don't have time. Who are some of his most famous students? Well, his grandson, Rav Baruch of Nesbitch, Rav Menachem Nachum of Chernobyl, the Maor Einayim. Rav Menachem Nachum of Chernobyl of 1730 to 1797. If you know someone named Twersky, they likely are related to Rav Menachem Nachum of Chernobyl. They're likely part of the Chernobyl dynasty. What happens with these students of the Baal Shem is that they create dynasties. I could have done flow charts and graphs, although I'm not that well attuned yet to what?
Rabbi
Abraham. Yeah, he's part of the Chernobyl dynasty. Skver Hasidus, New Square. The Rebbe's name is Twersky. It's an offshoot of Chernobyl dynasty. Chernobyl was known in Judaism before things were glowing in the dark. Before then, it was known for Hasidus. Rav Menachem Nachum of Chernobyl, he wrote a sefer, the Maor Einayim. I have a friend from Baltimore, his name is Shraga Goldenhirsch, but his mother is a Twersky. And we were in YU together, we were in KBY together, and he got all of his friends for our weddings. His wedding gift was a copy of the Maor Einayim, the sefer of Menachem Nachum of Chernobyl from the 18th century. And on the inside cover, he would write a flow chart tracing himself all the way back. That was his gift to each of us. Rav Dov Ber of Mezrich, we're going to get to him in a moment. He's one of the key students of the Baal Shem. Rav Pinchas of Karet, 1728 to 1790. Rav Yechiel Michal of Zlotchev, also 1721 to 1784. And as I said, I could have given you pages and pages of the students of the Baal Shem. The Baal Shem surrounds himself with an inner circle of loyal students to whom he passes on the mantle of Hasidus. What is Hasidus? Again, if you have to define it, what was his innovation? What did he create? So first of all, know that in Judaism, in these movements, be it Hasidus, be it the Musar movement, be it Brisker movement, none of these movements create something yesh me'ayin. None of them are creating something from nothing. What they all do is they shift an emphasis in Judaism. There's no radically new movement, because we're all bound by the written Torah, the oral Torah, rabbinic Judaism, the whole first section that you studied, the basics, right? The Medrash, the Mishnah, the Gemara. We're all bound by the same system of law. But these different movements are, for now, the Hasidic movement, shifts the emphasis, doesn't create something absolutely new. So how does it shift the emphasis? From pure scholarship, from a hierarchy of being a great scholar, Two, the Baal Shem wanting the average person, the farmer, the tailor, the blacksmith, to understand that if they're living a life with joy, simchas achayim, that if they're passionate in that which they're doing, in their prayer, in their charity, in their chesed, in their kindness, that they are as beloved by God, if not more. He seeks to elevate spiritually the amcha, the average person, and not just reserve Judaism for the elite. He's beloved, and his message resonates. Chassidim versus Misnagdim. Now, the Baal Shem mostly teaches a small circle of loyal students, including Rav Dov Ber of Mezrich, the Maggid of Mezrich, as we mentioned. By the way, the Maggid of Mezrich would have many great students. You're familiar with some of their names, likely. Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, the Berdichever, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, who we're going to talk about momentarily, and many others. Chassidim introducing, with the Baal Shem and his followers, they take a radical shift in ways it's hard for us to imagine. Chassidim are, first of all, changing the Nusach of Davening. They're taking the Arizal's emendations to our prayers, and they are publishing new prayer books based on Lurianic Kabbalah. They're going away from the traditional prayer book, and they're creating what we think of today as Nusach Sfard. I actually grew up, my grandfather was Nusach Sfard. So a Nusach Sfard sitter. Many Chassidim daven Nusach Sfard, which is more in common with Eidut HaMizrach than it does with Ashkenaz, because it's based on Kabbalah. It's based on the Ari, the Lurianic Kabbalah. That's one radical thing they're doing. But they're introducing all kinds of what are considered crazy practices. They're davening while doing flips and jumping jacks. I'm not exaggerating. If you read some of the testimony of what early Chassidim were doing to introduce a form of passion and enthusiasm, you'll say, that is bizarre. That's wild. That's crazy. They're jumping up and down during davening. They're screaming. They're banging their heads against the wall. They're changing some practices. For example, and these consist until today in some Hasidic sects, there is less emphasis on the strict observance of components of halacha if there's a feeling that that strict observance is taking away from the passion and the fervor. So if when you wake up in the morning, if you're so eager to daven by the time it's the latest time to say Shema, the latest time to say Shemona Esrei, but you haven't had a chance to meditate, to go to the mikveh, to learn, to have a piece of babka, then you're davening. What kind of davening will it be? I used to go to New Square. My sister worked in Camp Simcha. She had a camper from New Square. So we met the family through that. And went to New Square. Very interesting to see. New Square, if you don't know, is in Rockland County. It's in Muncie. It is a zip code that is entirely Skver Chassidim. There's only one way in and one way out. And when you get into the town, you are in White Russia. For all intents and purposes, you are taking a time machine to somewhere else. Fascinating. And so I became fascinated. And I ended up going 3 years in a row for Simchas Torah, for Yontif. After the first time I went, the second two times, I brought 9 friends from YU so we could make a minyan bizman. And the Rebbe found out about it, and he was okay with it. So the Skver Chassidim, I said, you know, we got that. It's mincha, it's shki, what's going on? We got daven, what's happening here? The Chassid says to me, you know what the problem is? He said, Ashkenazim, they say, Chassidim, we worship the Eibishter. You worship the Shkia. Which means, we worship God, you're worshiping sunset. And that's Chassidism introduced in the extreme fashion. Parts of it have remained until today. We worship the Eibishter, you worship the Shkia. Right? Like he said to me with the tie, the Chassid. He said, Chassidim wear a gartel to separate the heart from the lower extremities. He said, Misnagdim wear a tie, you're separating the head from the heart. Right? Those are the kinds of... They have like a book in New Square of lines to say to the... Right? I took you guys to a Hasidic Tish in Yerushalayim. You saw what it's like there. Fervor, enthusiasm, passion. And what you see today is a watered-down Hasidus. It's a nothing. The battle we're going to talk about in a moment, the war that raged between the Vilna Gaon and Hasidim, the Hasidim and the Misnagdim, it was a different Hasidus that the Vilna Gaon was fighting against. And historians have argued, and I, who am I, to concur, but I would concur, that thank God for the Groz opposition, because it weeded out the extremism from Hasidism to allow it to emerge, to blossom into what it is today, which is something wonderful. And the truth is, today, life is a hybrid. I'll never forget when I... I went to Boston. A group of rabbis met in Maimonides, that was then the Soloveitchik Institute. And we studied for 3 days together, and the highlight at the end of the 3 days, the rabbi in charge said, I won't even say his name, brought all the rabbis to the Beis Medrash in Maimonides so that we could look at and touch the shtender of the Rav. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, the Rav, a progeny of Brisk, ultimate Litvak, an offspring of the Gra of Misnagdim, and here we are, a group of rabbis touching his shtender. He would turn over in his grave a Brisker, a Litvak, that we care about his wooden shtender, learn his Torah, say over his Chakira, touch his shtender. But you see, Chassidus has entered Misnagdim, and Misnagdim have entered, you go into Chassidus, there's the learning, and there's a lot of blend that emerged between the two. But in the original Chassidus, if you read, and I have testimony, eyewitness accounts, what Chassidim were doing, it was radical, wacky, crazy, non-traditional, non-orthodox kinds of behaviors. Rabbinic leadership is worried that, oh no, here we go again. Think about it. It's a century later. We already had one bad result of Luriana Kabbalah. That was Shabtai Tzvi. Messianic movement was an outgrowth of the Ari. Here we go again. The Ari's teaching are leading to another distorted, inauthentic, counterfeit movement. So therefore, in 1772, the Vilna Gaon, Rav Eliyahu Kramer of Vilna, the undisputed greatest Torah leader, not only of his time, probably of the last 1,000 years, excommunicates Chassidim. Actually issues a chirim, a ban, excommunicates the entire movement of Chassidus. There is a war. It's not a battle. There is a war going on in Europe between Chassidim and Misnagdim. Now we come to Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. Born 5505, September 14, 1745, in White Russia, now Belarus. His father is Rav Baruch. People don't know this about Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the Balatanya, the creator of Chabad. He's a descendant of the Maharal, Rabbi Yehuda Lowy of Prague, 16th century, the great Maharal. Is the Maharal on the list for this year? Who's keeping these notes? The Maharal. Maharal's books. Maharal is one of those people. Nobody studied his books in his lifetime. Maharal was a wealthy businessman. He writes in one place that he recommends that all rabbis be independently wealthy. He says, a rabbi is best positioned when he's wealthy and his balabatim know he doesn't rely on them for the livelihood. Only then can he say what he wants to say. Shkayach, it was great advice. So, the Maharal's lifetime, his books were not studied. And actually, probably for centuries, they were not studied. And only today, there's no yeshiva that doesn't have Maharal, doesn't study Maharal. Reprintings, Rabbi Hartman is issuing new volumes of the Maharal, footnotes, absolutely incredible. So Rav Baruch, the father of Shneur Zalman, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, is a descendant of the Maharal of Prague. He's recognized as a child prodigy, as a genius. After a few years of marriage, and here this is the most pivotal part of his life that changes the course of Jewish history. He's married for a few years, and he decides he needs to grow to a great move to a great Torah center and grow further. He says, who am I? Right, part of greatness, a great leader has the humility to feel that they've not yet arrived. So he says, who am I? I know nothing. And he now is faced with a choice. Should he move to Vilna, the home of Rav Eliyahu Kramer, the Vilna Gaon, that's a picture of the Vilna Gaon, or should he move to Mezrich, the home of the great Magid, the student of the Baal Shem, Rav Dov Ber? That's his decision. He says, who am I? True, I'm a budding scholar, I learn a lot, but I know nothing about life, I know nothing about piety, I know nothing about religion, I need to grow. So should I move to Vilna and follow the Vilna Gaon? Or should I move to Mezrich and follow Rav Dov Ber and continue the line of Chassidus? Well, you all know, that's why we're sitting here tonight, what he decides. These are the two choices. He feels, this is what he's quoted as saying, he knew little about how to study Torah, but even less about how to pray. So he decides to go to Mezrich, a decision that would have a huge impact on Jewish destiny. These are Jews praying, Jews learning, in case you're trying to. So he couldn't decide. He says, I know little about learning, but I know even less about how to pray. I think many of us connect with that. We go through the motions of prayer. We've had moments where we feel like we had meaningful prayer. But boy, if we can go somewhere where we'd learn how to pray on fire, would add a fervor, would give us And that's what he decides to do, changing the course of Jewish history. He arrives in Mezrich in 1764, and he quickly enters as a young man, a prodigy, the Maggid of Mezrich, of Dover's inner circle of disciples. In 1770, recognizing Rav Schneur Zalman's talents and genius, the Maggid asks him to compile an updated Shulchan Aruch. So here, what's happening? There's a war raging where Hasidim, or Misnagdim rather, the Vilna Gaon, is relentlessly declaring Hasidus as a distortion of Judaism. Right? Hasidus is the new Jews for Jesus. Hasidus is the Kabbalah center. Hasidus is a distortion, a deviation from authentic Judaism. That's the Vilna Gaon. The undisputed, universally recognized Torah giant of the generation is tearing apart Hasidus daily. So what does the Maggid of Mezrich do? He says, how are we going to gain some credibility that we're not radical innovators, but we too believe in traditional Judaism? He says, we need to compose a Shulchan Aruch. We need to show that we have a loyalty and allegiance, a fidelity to Jewish law. So he commissions Rav Schneur Zalman, this young prodigy who's entered his inner circle, and he gives him a task. He says, I see as a young man, you're brilliant, you have organizational skills, you believe in Hasidus, but you're steeped in learning. And he tasks him with authoring a new Shulchan Aruch. Rav Yosef Karo, we didn't study Shulchan Aruch yet, right? Because we didn't go through Halacha. No. So you're going to study the Shulchan Aruch. Rav Yosef Karo, the 16th century, late 16th century. And Shulchan Aruch, what the Shulchan Aruch introduces and what the Shulchan Aruch contributes. You'll get to the Shulchan Aruch. So here you're a few hundred years later, and the Maggid says, we need an updated, amended Shulchan Aruch, and it will give us credibility. If out of Hasidism comes an authoritative work on Halacha, who can dismiss us as trying to distort the tradition, as trying to be some newfangled religion? So he gives that task to Rav Schneur Zalman of Liadi. It would show the Misnagdim Hasidim could learn and cared about Halacha. Here's a tragic story. Rav Schneur Zalman of Liadi labors for years. He organizes, he writes, but most of the manuscripts are lost in a fire. Only parts survive, including most of Or Chaim. Shulchan Aruch, you'll study, is broken into four sections. Or Chaim, Yerodea, Eben Ezer, Choshen Mishpat. Most of the manuscript is lost on a fire. What we have today is Or Chaim, the first section, what the Mishnah Berurah is written on, and parts of Yerodea, but very little from Eben Ezer, Choshen Mishpat. Very sad. This, we have it in our library, I have it at home. Every rabbinic library has a copy of what's called Shulchan Aruch HaRav. Shulchan Aruch HaRav, or the Rav Shulchan Aruch. The Rav Shulchan Aruch is Rav Schneur Zalman's emendation, writing, reissuing a Shulchan Aruch. It's brilliant. It's written concisely. It's written clearly. He has a mastery over the Hebrew language. And despite opposition to Hasidism, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav enters halachic literature. Rav Dov Ber, the Maggid's plan works in that the Shulchan Aruch HaRav is not dismissed as some new distorted view of Judaism, but it works. In an attempt to make it universal, this is very interesting, the Baal HaTanya, Rav Schneur Zalman, did not incorporate what will be Chabad Minhagim into the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. As an Ashkenazic Jew, living in Boca Raton, when I open up a Shulchan Aruch HaRav and study Halacha, it's relevant to me. It incorporates my practices. It's not written for the Chabad Chassid. The Rav Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, is written in a somewhat universal way. Where does he put the Chabad practices? In his? In his Siddur. The Rebbe issues a Siddur. It's based on the Ari, the Nusach Ari. It's got what will become the Chabad practices, the Lubavitch practices, and that he puts in the Siddur. But his Shulchan Aruch HaRav, he leaves somewhat universal. Chabad and the Vilna Gaon, the showdown. Oh, if I was good, I would have had one of those Western... The showdown in Vilna. Here it comes. 1767. Rav Schneur Zalman becomes the Maggid in his hometown of Liozna. He goes home, he becomes the Maggid. What exactly is the position of Maggid? Where does it fit between Rabbi and Gabbai? And not for now. But he becomes the Maggid, a spiritual leader. He attracts followers who want to study with him. 1772, he forms three Chadarim, three groups of students. And that's where he first develops his whole concept which we'll talk about in a moment at length, of Chabad. Chabad is not a place. Lubavitch is a place. We associate Lubavitch Hasidim, but interesting, Rav Shneur Zalman was not from Lubavitch. He ultimately dies in Liadi at the end of his life. He's known as Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, and he wasn't even there for most of his life, only at the end of his life. It's Liozna that he's really, it's where he's born, it's where he raised, and where he goes back to become a Maggid. But in any case, it's 1772 that he comes up and introduces to these young students this concept, this new formulation called Chabad, Chochma Bina Das. We'll talk about it in a moment. And therefore, it's that year, 1772, which is considered to be the founding year of Chabad Hasidus. 1774, Schneider Zalman and his teacher slash colleague, Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, they go on a mission. Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk is the real... he receives the mantle from Rav Dov Berer, from the Maggid of Mezrich. He's the real next in line to be the head of... It went from the Baal Shem to Rav Dov Berer, the Maggid of Mezrich, to Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk. So he is a teacher slash colleague to Rav Schneur Zalman of Liadi. The two of them say, we've had it. There's proclamations, there's excommunications, there's false accusations, there's physical violence. We've had it. We've had it. We're going to Vilna, and we're going to bring peace. They go to Vilna, and what happens? The Vilna Gaon refuses to meet with them. The Vilna Gaon refuses to meet with them. In Chabad lore, it's known, they say that if the Vilna Gaon would have met with Rav Schneur Zalman of Liadi that fateful day, Mashiach would be here. Mashiach would be here. That decision not to meet allowed history to continue until this point. Here I have, comes from a book, The Man in His Image, about the Gaon of Vilna, The Man in His Image. It quotes here, additional information that supplements and clarifies the picture is found in a passage from the letter of Schneur Zalman of Liadi. So this is from his letter itself, Rav Schneur Zalman. We went to the Gaon HaChassid, may his candle burn brightly. Notice, by the way, the reverence with which he continues to speak about him. To his house to debate with him and to remove his complaints from us. While I was there with the Chassid rabbi, our late teacher of Menach Al-Harsener of blessed memory, and the Gaon closed his door before us twice. And when the great people of the city spoke to him, saying, Rabbi! The famous rabbi of theirs had come to debate with his venerable holy Torah. And when he is defeated, certainly thereafter there will be peace. He put them off with delays. And when they began to implore him greatly, he left and went away and traveled from the city, remaining there until our departure. So here you have Rav Schneur Zalman of Liadi, Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, planting themselves in Vilna. We're not leaving till we meet with the Vilna Gaon. We have to resolve this conflict and bring peace. What does the Vilna Gaon do? Sneaks out the back door. And when they remain there at departure from the city, afterward in our country, we traveled to the holy congregation of Shklov, also to debate. We did not succeed. And they did something to us that was not right. They broke their word and the promise they had given us at first not to do anything to us. Only when they saw that they had nothing to respond to our words, did they come with a strong arm and suspend themselves from a high tree. Agon HaChasim. Name. So here you have the first-hand testimony of Schneur Zalman describing the attempt to meet with the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon avoiding him, and what I think is very fascinating, in 1797, when the Vilna Gaon passed away, certain Hasidim expressed happiness and joy at the news of his death. He was their arch nemesis. He was their arch rival. He was the thorn in their side. He was the man who denied their right to exist. Rav Schneur Zalman of Liadi issues a public letter forbidding such statements, requiring his followers to speak of the greatness of the Vilna Gaon. I think that speaks volumes of Rav Schneur Zalman. That here, the man who denied his whole philosophy and way of life. Now, personally, I think it also speaks to perhaps what was an inner conflict within Rav Schneur Zalman of Liadi. Remember back to a few years after he was married, when he was trying to decide where to go. Does he move to Vilna and become a student of the Vilna Gaon? Does he move to Mezrich and become a follower of Rav Dov Berer, the Maggid of Mezrich? And while he chose to move to Mezrich because he wanted to learn how to pray, I think the admiration and the reverence he had for the Vilna Gaon never dissipated. And though he never rejected the Vilna Gaon, all he wanted was the approval of the Vilna Gaon for his lifestyle. So much so that when the Vilna Gaon dies, he issues this proclamation, and by then he is an authority, he is a voice, that everyone is to continue to speak of the Vilna Gaon with great awe and reverence. In the same year, 1774, following the death of a Maggid, Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk viewed as the leader of Hasidus. But what happens? 1777, 3 years later. So Rav Dov Ber, the Magid of Mezrich, dies. Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk is the logical heir. But in 1777, by being the heir as the leader of Hasidus, something else he inherits, and that is a big fat target on his chest. So the Misnagdim, the snags, as Chabad still likes to call some people, the Misnagdim are going after now Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, threatening him, threatening to go to the government to him, doing everything that they can to stop this wave that's growing of Hasidus. He's forced to flee. And he emigrates, he moves to Israel. And he takes a whole court of Hasidim with him. There's a Hasidic Aliyah to Israel. Shneir Zalman Eliadi is originally part of the group. First goes with Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk to Israel, but returns home, where he emerges the de facto leader of all of Hasidus. He creates a system of shlichim so he could send messengers to other locations. He so believes in this philosophy of Hasidus as a whole, and Chabad in particular, which we'll talk about in a moment, that he begins this idea of wanting to propagate, of wanting to promulgate, of wanting to spread the message of this movement. He became too popular. What happened was, he wanted to... Let me take a step back. There are different models of Hasidic Rebbes emerging. By this time, you have all the students of the Baal Shem. Each of the students of the Baal Shem have their own students, and their own students. There are now many courts, Hasidic courts, that are emerging. And Rebbes emerge in different models. In some rabbinic courts, in some Hasidic courts, the Rebbe is an intermediary. The Rebbe is the tzaddik, he is the intermediary to Hashem. When I need something from Hashem, I go to the tzaddik to daven for me. When I need to make a decision, I go to the Rebbe to make the decision, to tap into his divine inspiration and tell me. Shneir Zalman of Liadi doesn't like that model. He doesn't subscribe to the model of the Rebbe as an intermediary, but he sees the Rebbe as an educator. The Rebbe's mission to educate and to inspire and to empower his Hasidim. Don't come to me to be the intermediary to Hashem. Let me teach you how to pray on your own behalf to Hashem. Don't come to me to make decisions. Let me teach you how to conquer your Yetzer Hara, conquer your evil inclination. And so, he is trying to educate, he's trying to inspire, and he's spending time with people. One-on-one. He's teaching Hasidus. He's teaching what it means to live a life of fervor, enthusiasm, to have a neshama that's on fire, to have a spirit that's alive. But he starts to grow frustrated because he becomes so popular. It's like this week's Parsha, what Yisro sees of Moshe Rabbeinu, that there are long lines and he can't have access, he can't get the time. It's like what happens with medicine when doctors can't spend that much time with patients anymore. The outside forces, he feels as the spiritual doctor, he can't spend that much time with his patients. He realized he could spread his message, therefore he would have much better success. He could get the message out much more widely by writing a book. Not only teaching one-on-one, but writing a book. Originally posts anonymous, publishes anonymously, but only later by name. Now, here are landmark events in Rav Shneir Zalman of Liadi's life. And we'll be at the Tanya in a couple minutes. He authors the Tanya when he decides that he needs to get the message out to a wider audience in 1797 as a systematic articulation of the fundamentals of Hasidus. The influence spreads throughout White Russia, Lithuania, and even Vilna. You can imagine, the hometown of the Vilna Gaon. It enters the capital of Misnagdus, the capital of the opposition to his movement. He's penetrating that fortress of Misnagdim, and Hasidic values are entering White Russia, Lithuania, and even Vilna. Misnagdim see him now as a growing threat. His Tanya is spreading. His message is spreading. Hasidus is spreading. So what do? It's not working when they get up in shul and say, Hasidim, no good. Don't do business with people who are Hasidim. It's not working. So what do they do? They go to the Russian government. And they say, Shneir Zalman, we have evidence that he's sending money to Israel because he's sending money to the Sultan of Turkey, who is not in the best interests of Russia. They go to the Russian government and say, Rishnei Azalman is conspiring with the Sultan of Turkey. He's sending them money. Now the truth is, was he sending money? Absolutely. Who was he sending the money to? Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, the Hasidim who went on that Aliyah, the Hasidic movement that's growing in Israel. But it doesn't matter. The Mesnagdim falsely accuse him. And what happens? In 1798, he's arrested with a capital crime and he's tried in St. Petersburg. After the trial, he's released from prison. He's exonerated of all charges. What's the date that he's exonerated and released from prison? Yud Tes Kislev. Our second date on the Chabad calendar. Yud Tes Kislev of 1798. There's a whole story about his being released from prison and going to an apartment building, and the first he sees a misnagid. There's a lot of stories about what happens when he emerges. But he interprets that day, Yud Tes Kislev, the 19th of Kislev, as he's sitting in prison, falsely accused, with the threat of capital punishment, or minimally spending the rest of his life. Here you have a charismatic leader who is spurning a movement, a wave of Hasidus. He's not doing it for himself. He's not doing it for his own ego, self-aggrandizement. He's doing it because he believes he has a message for the Amcha. He's injecting a spirituality into what was a dry, dull Jewish people. And now he's sitting in prison saying to himself, maybe I got it wrong. Maybe my message was all wrong. Maybe this whole Hasidus is wrong. Maybe I should have gone to Vilna. Maybe Kabbalah, mysticism, it shouldn't be spread so widely. Maybe it is reserved for the few. Maybe I got it all wrong. And when he's exonerated on the 19th of Kislev, and when he's released from prison, he understands his release, that just as the court here on earth found in his favor, his release is a message from on high that God also is found in his favor and that he's on the right path. He sees the 19th of Kislev as a watershed moment that confirms or affirms for him that everything he's doing and spreading is absolutely correct, is absolutely right, and that he needs to continue to do it. And he walks out of that prison on the 19th of Kislev with an absolutely renewed sense of enthusiasm and mission to spread Hasidus, to spread Tanya, to spread Chabad, to change the world. And therefore, Chabad Hasidim look back at that date, the 19th of Kislev. It's celebrated on the Chabad calendar as the Rosh Hashanah of Chabad, the Rosh Hashanah of Hasidus. The Rosh Hashanah, like the Day of Judgment, God found in Rav Shneur Zalman's favor, God paskened, God judged in his favor, that what he's doing is correct, that which he's publishing is correct, and he should continue to do so, and that's what he does. A second accusation, however, comes in the year 1800. This time he sits in prison a lot longer. On his release, it's interesting, there's nothing on the Chabad calendar to mark that he went back into prison, but okay. On his release from prison that second time, that's when he first moves to Liadi. What happens is in 1812, this is now the end of his life. So 1800, 1812. 1812, Napoleon invades Russia. Everyone in Russia has a choice. You got to take a side. Are you with the French? Are you with the Russians? Whose side are you on? Rav Shneur Zalman takes a side. Whose side does he take? Takes the Russians. Why? Very interesting calculation. He's afraid that if the French enter right Russia, they will emancipate the Jews, and that great freedom and mobility will lead to assimilation and intermarriage. And he therefore prefers to support the Russians and anticipates Judaism will do better under Russian oppression than French liberation. So he sides with the Russians. How do you think Napoleon felt about that? He didn't take that too well. He's one of the greatest, most vocal opponents of the French conquest. The French, and this was the reason why, the French advance into White Russia. He's forced to keep retreating. Shneur Zalman of Liadi, Liadi is the last city he lives, spends the last months of his life on the run. In 1812, on the 24th of Teves, by the way, notice that this was 200 years ago. About 3 weeks ago, we celebrated the 200th Yahrzeit of the Alter Rebbe. 5583, he dies in the remote village of Pirn. He's buried in nearby Aditz. This is his grave today. You can visit. This is inside. This is the outside, the building. This is inside, where it continues to be visited by Chabad Hasidim until today. So that is the background of the Alter Rebbe. That what we saw so far is Lurianic Kabbalah in the 16th century opens up Kabbalah to the masses. It was hidden when it was only in the Zohar. On the heels of Lurianic Kabbalah, Kabbalah is accessible to the masses. Concepts of redemption, reincarnation, repair, and messianism comes Shabtai Tzvi and a wave of false messiahs. After Shabtai Tzvi and the wave of false messiahs in the next century, in the 18th century, we have the birth of Hasidus, the Baal Shem, trying to fill a need, a void, for the Hamonam, the Amcha, the average pious but almost illiterate Jew who needs some passion, some light, some enthusiasm. Baal Shem successfully lights the fire, passes the torch to the Maggid of Mezrich, of Dov Ber, who passes the torch to, through Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, through to Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, who really lights the world on fire with his Hasidus. He writes his Tanya, he reaches many people, he's written a Shulchan Aruch HaRav as a young age, he published his Siddur, he publishes his Tanya, first anonymously, only later, under his name, and he's changing the world until he's forced to flee when Napoleon enters. On the run in Russia, he dies and is buried there. Any questions about the Baal HaTanya, about Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, before we now examine his book and what he was trying to spread? Yes. The glass in the mikvah?
Yeah.
Like, I'm not sure.
There's something like the mikvah versus the mishnah and the glass in the
mikvah. Oh, that the Hasidim used to use the mikvah so they put glass to hurt themselves?
No,
they hurt
the others.
I don't know. There's all kinds. There's a wonderful book that was published by Jason Aronson, which tracked the battle of the Hasidim and the Misnagdim, the Vilna Gaon versus the Baal Shem. It was a scholarly work. It's a green cover. I don't remember its name. And it has all this testimony and all these quotations. And you can't imagine what they were doing to one another. Physical violence, false accusations, excommunications, dismissals. They were arguing about everything. You know, the Hasidim introduced, for example, a practice. Anyone in here not eat gebrachts on Pesach? So my wife's maiden name is Brookstein. And her grandfather, she comes from Hasidim. So they were known, they would go away to a hotel for Pesach as the non-Gebruchsteins. Because they didn't eat Gebrucht. Hasidim, that was Hasidim. Hasidim introduced this idea that even once it's baked as matzah, if it comes in contact with liquid, it could become chametz. And Vilna Gaon hears this and he says, it's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. Excuse me, that's amaratzis. Once you bake the flour and water into matzah, it's matzah. It can't become. So what does the Vilna Gaon do? He makes a matzah ball. What's a matzah ball? It's matzah mixed with water. And where does he put the matzah ball? In his window of his house for 8 days of Pesach. For the world to see that the matzah ball, that he's eating the matzah ball. There's the testimony over what happened during those years. Again, it's for another time. You could do a 10-part series on the battle between Hasidim and Misnagdim. But anything else specific about Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the Alter Rebbe?
Yeah, I'm thinking of, in my own time, the idea of making spirituality so much more accessible to so many people, the connection to physicality, and the way of improving the world, the recommended wisdom is to bring more spirituality into the physical world through nullification.
Exactly. We're going to get to all of that in a moment. Absolutely. Absolutely. We're going to talk about that in a moment. When we get into the book in a second, we'll get into that. Anything about his life, and then we'll get into the book for the remainder of our time. Hinda, his life? Yes, David.
Why is the movement called Lubavitch if he never lived in Lubavitch?
The truth is, I don't think it's called Lubavitch, but I mean, maybe Faye can speak to this better than I can. It's really, it's Chabad, and that's because of the philosophy that he introduces that we'll see in a movement. Lubavitch is where the movement moves, or where it grows, but I don't know. We think of it as Lubavitch. I think within the movement, they think of it more as Chabad.
No, they both.
It started as Lubavitch. Lubavitch is a city in White Russia. Right. It's a town in Russia where the Chabad were living. I don't know when it became associated or which name they chose. Yes? Right.
Connecting with Hashem, and maybe for the average person in the room, with any kind of learning at the same time.
Oh, it's a great question. We'll see in the Tanya. We'll see right now. Okay, so let's go to Tanya. Yeah?
Yes.
Great. For the remainder of our time. Tanya is known by three names. By the way, the Rebbe himself, you've heard me tonight refer to him as Rav Shneur Zalman. Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. The Alter Rebbe. Alter means old. The oldest. The Alter Rebbe. He's the oldest, the first Rebbe. Or the Balatanya. So he's known as Rav Shneur Zalman, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. The Alter Rebbe, the Balatanya. His book is also known by three names. The book is known as Tanya. The term Tanya, he never named the book Tanya. The book's not called Tanya. Where did the word Tanya come from? It's the opening word of the book. And the word Tanya is the same word Tanya that you studied when you learned about Gemara. The Gemara, when it quotes a Braisa, refers to the teaching of a Braisa as Tanya. If you learn Talmud, if you learn the Gemara, if you learn Daf Yomi, you can't go five lines without you're seeing the word Tanya. It says in a Braisa. So he begins the book, Tanya. It says in a Braisa. And he quotes it, and it became known as the first word of the book, Tanya. But Tanya is not some creative name that he came up with. That's the first name. The real name that he named it is Sefer HaBeinonim. And that's what we're going to see for the remainder of our time. The Beinoni is the hero of Tanya. You know why that's awesome? We're going to see. Because every one of us can aspire to be a Beinoni. If you told me the hero of Tanya is the Tzaddik, I say, that's not really a book for me. Maybe that's a book about some righteous woman, some righteous man, the guy who sits in the Beis Medrash, the person who does the tzedakah, the person who gives the chesed. Me, I struggle with a lot of faults and failures and shortcomings. This book is the Sefer HaBeinonim. It is the guidebook. In fact, some have described it that the Balatanya Rav Shneur Zalman provided for the average person, he provided the equivalent of what the Rambam Maimonides did in his time. Maimonides provided the rational guide for the perplexed, and Rav Shneur Zalman provides the guide for the perplexed of Chassidus. So the guide for the perplexed of the average person, the guide of Chassidus for the perplexed. It's the book of intermediates, which we'll have to define in a moment, because it's different than what you think. And the third possibility is Likutei Amarim, which means collection of teachings. Why? Well, two reasons. First of all, he says in his introduction, which we have time, I printed for you, because maybe we'll go through, but he says, similar to what the Ramchal, what Mesilas Yesharim says in his introduction, which is, I have nothing new. I just collected smart things other people said, but there couldn't be anything further from the truth. The Tanya is an incredibly creative, innovative, amazing work. But Likutei Amarim means a collection of sayings, and that's what he presented it as being. Moreover, it's made up of five essays, which we'll see. He only published the first three in the original Tanya, in the original Sefer HaBeinonim. The last two essays were published in 1814 after he was gone, posthumously actually. So Likutei Amarim, a collection of letters, of essays, a collection of sayings. So this book is known by three names. It's most commonly known as the Tanya, though no one ever named it that. That's just the opening word. Its real name is the Sefer HaBeinonim. That's the name he gave it. Or alternatively, the Likutei Amarim. So you see, in fact, here on an authentic version of Tanya, that's what it says on top. What is the purpose of Tanya? What was Rav Shneur Zalman seeking to communicate? What is in this book, which I can't highly recommend enough for you to try to study? Number one, he doesn't delve into specific problems. His goal is not to say, okay, time management. Okay, Yetzirah for women. Yetzirah for chocolate cake. Yetzirah for Lashon Hara. We're going to go through them one by one and we're going to solve them. That's not what the book does. What the book does is it delves into the root causes of human failings. Human psychology. The Balatanya was greater than any psychologist, sociologist, social psychologist that you can imagine. What he provides in this book is a penetrating insight into human psychology, into the root causes of human failing. And he does so by suggesting the following. The inner workings of the inner soul and an analysis of good and evil as fundamental forces competing within the soul. Early on in the first chapter of the introduction, he says that man is made up of two souls. Right? I'll read to you. He writes, the explanation is to be found in light of what Reb Chaim Vital writes, that every Jew, tzaddik and rasha alike, are two souls. As it is written, the souls, in plural, neshamos, which I have made. That is, two souls. writes the Baal HaTanya. One soul originates in Klipa and Sitra Achra. This is the soul that's clothed in the blood of human being, given life to the body, and so on. There are anger and pride which emanate from the elements of fire. He then goes through all of the that soul. From this soul also derive the good characteristics that are to be found in the innate of every Jew. And then there is the godly soul. So the premise of the Tanya is that all misgivings, shortcomings, doubts, challenges, temptations, all that we struggle with is the result of the fact that we have a dual personality. Every human being suffers from multiple personality disorder. We all have multiple souls. There are two souls competing within us. There's the soul of good and the evil. Fundamental forces competing within us. Not external to us, but internal within us. He sees all human imperfection, all struggles, all doubts, all drives, all temptations as expressions of one basic problem. The struggle between good and evil. So, Mesilas Yesharim, if you've studied it, you're going to study it, it's in this course. Ramchal of Moshe Chaim Lutzato, the author of the Mesilas Yesharim, he writes this multi-step program. It begins with Zehirus, Zrizus, Nikias, and so on, Precious. Mesilas Yesharim follows a path of steps. Complete this step and climb to the next step. Climb to the next step. Climb to the next step. The Tanya, though we read the whole Mesilas Yesharim and no one's ever made it past the first step, but in theory, it's supposed to be written in a way that we complete steps and move on. Tanya is written very differently. The Tanya is written that you read the whole Tanya and you're working simultaneously. There's one unified message throughout, and so everything is building on what comes before. And here is the premise. Pretty good, huh? Like that? Come on, wake up! Look at that PowerPoint! Thank you, thank you. So this is the premise of the Tanya. All of Tanya can be reduced to this slide. Shneur Zalman would be so proud of my slide. All of it can be reduced. And that struggle, the battle that wages within each and every one of us, it expresses itself as temptation, doubt, desire, and so on. That's how it expresses itself. But at its root, at its source, at its core, it's the battle between the godly soul and the animal soul. What are the godly soul and the animal soul? That's you. That's man. On the one end, we have the nefesh elokus, what he calls. The nefesh elokus aspires to the divine, is reaching. It's a beautiful Rabbeinu Bachya, by the way, who says, why do animals walk on all four and human beings walk on two? Rabbeinu Bachya says, because the animal is brought down to the earth. That's where the animal eats, where the animal feels physical, it's where the animal desires. The human being, even if it's subconscious, we're yearning, we're reaching up, we're pulling up to, we want spirituality. This earthly world is holding us down, but it's spirituality which is where we really want to be. So the nefesh elokus, we aspire for the divine. I want to feel connected. I want to feel God's presence. I want to feel experience transcendence. I want to live a life of discipline. Godliness is discipline. When I look at that chocolate cake and I say, I have no interest in you. When I hear that Lashon Hara and I say, I have no interest in you. When I have that opportunity to be dishonest in business and I say, not me. When I am disciplined, rigidly disciplined, when I express my capacity to control my destiny, I am in touch with my godliness. I am alive. Isn't that what it feels like to be alive? Isn't that what it feels like to be good, satisfied? That's being alive, aspiring for the divine, transcendence, discipline, to be in touch with the godly spirit. That's one part of who every single one of us is. We all live with that nefesh elokus. On the other hand, however, we all have, my friend Betty over here, we all have the nefesh behemis. The nefesh behemis is within us as well. What is that? It's our physical identity. It's the material world. It's what drives us to want a nicer house and a nicer car. It's what drives us to eat more food even though I'm full, and to lie on the couch and stuff my face, and to indulge in physical pleasure and physicality and material pursuits. There's an animal. I am no different than this cow. There's a piece inside me that just has, in fact, it's entered our vernacular if you think about it. What do you call when your kid's room is messy? You say it looks like a pigsty. And when you see somebody who's stuffing their face, you say, you're eating like an animal, you're eating like a pig. What is an animal characterized as? Instinct, intuition. An animal wants to do something, it does it. It's on your tree, on your neighbor's tree, it's with your female dog, your neighbor's, whatever your animal wants, it does. Instinct, intuition. The animal never says, let me go on a date first, let's build a relationship. The animal doesn't say, before I lift my leg, who's watching, is there my privacy? The animal doesn't say, if I eat this, how am I going to look in those jeans? The animal doesn't ask these questions. The animal has an instinct, the animal has an impulse, the animal wants, and the animal eats. Aspect of the human soul. There's a nefesh behemoth, which is an aspect of the human soul. Not inherently negative, it can be refined. Here's the chiddush of the Baal HaTanya. You see, the goal is not this picture. I thought he was just taking a little off the top. That's the barber, that's the sheep. See? Oh, boom! Oh! See, that's not... Here, like that, let me do that again. Watch that. Bam! Look at that. So that's not the goal. The goal is not to slaughter the animal soul. Before I provided this class for you tonight, and if you've never learned Tanya, you would have said, what does Judaism teach me? Slaughter the animal instinct within me. To be a tzaddik, to be a righteous person means I don't have physical pleasure. I'm not drawn to physical pleasure. I don't have a physical identity. I'm not drawn to the material world. I'm transcendent. I'm disciplined. I'm a godly soul. And I slaughter the animal instinct within me. Comes along the Baal HaTanya and he says, whoa. The animal instinct is a part of who you are. Here's this incredible psychological insight. If you try to slaughter it, all you will be doing is denying a piece of who you are. That's all you'll be doing. Instead, confront that it's a piece of who you are, channel it, refine it, turn it, nourish it towards positive results. Animal soul is not fundamentally evil. So the battle for the Baal HaTanya, and this is a theme throughout the book, is that our job is not to slaughter the animal, the nefesh behemoth. Our job is to educate the nefesh behemoth. The nefesh elokus is the core of who we are. We also have a nefesh behemoth. To deny it is to deny our very existence. To say we're going to slaughter it is to pretend something that will never happen. Instead, embrace it, educate it, train the animal soul, elevate it to a higher level of awareness and understanding. Seek peace and harmony of the body and the soul, the earthliness and the transcendence. You understand what a novel idea that is? It doesn't sound so novel maybe to you, but certainly contrasted with other modes of chassidus, and contrasted with other modes of righteousness, pursuit of righteousness, it is unbelievably comforting. It's amazingly resonating to the average person like me, who sometimes eats the chocolate cake and struggles with the snooze button and doesn't want to exercise and has some juicy lashon hara to share and doesn't always look at or say or listen to the right thing. The message of the Baal HaTanya is, I'm not a reject. I'm not an oisvarf. I'm not a lowlife. I'm not a nothing because I can't be a tzaddik. I'm engaged in a struggle. That's righteousness. You understand how empowering? You understand how comforting? You understand how revolutionary his message? He's not endorsing slaughtering the nefesh behemoth. He's endorsing educating it, inspiring it, channeling it. Peace and harmony. Don't pretend you're a soul with no body. Find harmony between the body and the soul. Don't pretend you live transcendent and you're not earthly. Find the peace and harmony between the two. And that's what it means to be a Beinonim. It's the Sefer HaBeinonim. It is the book of the intermediaries. What does that mean? What are Beinonim? So, normally you'd think, the Rambam, let's go to Rosh Hashanah for a minute. Rosh Hashanah time. How many books are open in front of God? There's the book of the righteous, Sefer HaTzadikim. There's the Sefer HaRishayim, the wicked, and there's the Sefer HaBeinonim. this whole tradition, Unisana Tokef, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, we're trying to tip the scales. The righteous, ooh, he's on the scale, he's tipping the scale of good. The wicked, tipping the scale down to bad. And for us, normally, classically, what's the Beinoni? Who's the intermediate? 50-50. Righteous, evil. The next move you make will determine who you are. Comes along the Bala Tanya and he says, Beinoni is not... Beinoni is not... It's not 50-50 scales. The Beinoni is not 50-50 scales. You know what the Beinoni is? The Beinoni is the one who's in a state of war. The Beinoni is the individual who's in a state of war. In fact, the Beinoni can achieve what we would describe as a tzaddik. The tzaddik, in the Bala Tanya's formulation, here's the Rasha, here's the Beinoni, here's the tzaddik. The tzaddik is somebody whose soul is so superior that their nefesh behemis doesn't even exist. And the Rasha is somebody who has conceded the battle. The tzaddik has won the battle. You know, there's those people in our lives who are so annoying because they're just all good. They're all... There's some people in our lives, they don't have anything bad ever to say about anybody. They're like the perfect specimen of health. They never eat anything bad. They only exercise. They're disciplined. They're good. So they're the tzaddik, right? The tzaddik is just... There's no battle. The nefesh... Elokus has destroyed the Nefesh Behemoth, they're one. The Russia has lost the battle. The Russia are those wicked people who have decided, I'm not even engaged in a struggle. I'm just indulging in the physical world. Carpe diem, enjoy life, forget it. No discipline, no distinction, no life of being distinguished. I'm just intuition, what I want, desire, temptation, boom. Nefesh Behemoth. Who's the Beinoni? It's nothing to do with 50-50 in scales. It all has to do with the struggle. Winning the struggle, losing the struggle, and the Beinoni is engaged in the struggle. The Beinoni is the one who is a lifelong struggle. And the Beinoni is the hero of the book. So when you read the Tanya, you're reading about yourself. You're not reading, you read Mesilas Yesharim, you're reading about some tzaddik. I hope maybe someday, yeah. It's not me. You read the Tanya, you're reading, you're holding up a mirror. That's me, I'm the Beinoni. I have those struggles, I have those doubts. I have those temptations. I live with that tension. For the Tanya, the tzaddik is the person whose life is stable. The Beinoni is the one who's living with tension and struggle. The tzaddik's life is like flatlined. And the Beinoni's life looks like the stock market. Up and down and up and down and up and down. It's a life of struggle. Most Muslim books directed at becoming a tzaddik, the Tanya recognizes not everyone can achieve absolute victory. The Beinoni is the state of war. But we can, here's the Chiddush of the Tanya. The Beinoni is a struggle, is not going to transform the soul to get rid of the animal soul. But you know what the Beinoni can do? The Beinoni can put on the Levush. The Levush is the garments. The soul has garments. The soul wears three garments in the thought of the Tanya. We would look through all of this inside, but we don't have time, but I'm giving you some of the flavor of Tanya. Faye will tell you if that's true or not. And then the flavor of Tanya. What are the garments of the soul? There are three garments that the soul wears. Machshava, Dibur, and Maisa. Thought, action, and speech. In other words, thought, action, and speech don't necessarily reveal what's happening inside me. They don't necessarily reveal that the battle is over, the war is won, there's no longer an animal instinct. I could be thin, triathlete, unbelievably healthy, and you look at me and say, that person has no desire. And little do you know that every time I go to the supermarket, that Entenmann's aisle is like a torturous experience for me. That's the Beinoni. On the outside, we wear the garment. And that's what God wants of us. God doesn't expect you to be able to walk through the Entenmann's aisle and say, ah, Entenmann's, that's like just poison, I have no interest. God understands that for the Beinoni, Entenmann's will always be delicious. But the Machshava, the thought, the Dibur, the speech, and the Maisa, the action, I can exhibit the behavior of the Nefesh Elokus over the Nefesh Behemoth. Even if not in the essence of the soul. That's the Beinoni. Beinoni is a person of struggle. There's a chassid who once came to the Alter Rebbe, Reb Shneur Zalman, of Li'adi. And he said, Rebbe, I haven't arrived. I've tried so hard. I've been struggling my whole life. I haven't arrived. And the Rebbe said to him, well, what do you mean you haven't arrived? He said, these thoughts still haunt me. I'm tempted by women I shouldn't be looking at, and doubts about my parnassa, and every day is a struggle. I haven't arrived at this destination. When am I going to get there? And the Rebbe said to him, if you're engaged in the struggle, that is the destination. You have arrived. Many are not even engaged in the struggle. The Russia has forfeited the battle, has conceded the war. The Beinoni is engaged in the struggle. And says the Alter Rebbe, in the most comforting way, that's the destination. That's arriving. Being in the struggle, the friction, the tension. Identify and recognize that undesirable lusts and thoughts and doubts come from within a component of ourselves, and we may not have the power to uproot it totally. I was at a rabbinic, I hosted a group of 12 rabbis four weeks ago. One of those rabbis also has a PhD in psychology, and the last session of our conversation, we were having it was actually a fascinating discussion, because he's built a business. He's in Baltimore. He's built a business. He's a practicing rabbi of a shul, a large shul. He's one of a team of rabbis. And he's built a business as a therapist, as a psychologist, of doing consulting in financial planning for wealthy families. So wealthy families are doing their financial planning. What do they leave to the children? Fights between the children, fights within the family. He brings his psychological insight. Fine. So we're having a fascinating conversation. And in the conversation, everyone's sharing different things. And I happen to share something about myself and about my rabbinate and about wanting to be accessible or needing to be liked and having this whole conversation. And I'm not sure I should be admitting this in front of a tape recorder in a room full of people. But maybe there is vodka in my bottle here. But in any case, so it was. He said something which was so liberating to me. It was unbelievable. I shared something, as I just described to you, with him. And he said, and I said to him something like, you know, I don't like that aspect, or I wish I didn't have it, or I'm working to not have it. And he said to me, why? Why are you working to not have it? He says, you need to admit it and confront it and realize it, that it is an aspect of what drives you, of who you are, of your motivation. And now you can deal with it in a healthy way. But as long as you try to deny it and subjugate it, and as long as you try to annihilate it and slaughter it, then you're only going to feel guilty for having it, but you're not actually going to make progress. And it was amazingly liberated to be told, maybe you have something which is an imperfection, and it's okay. Accept it. And now learn to channel it, or learn to conform to it, and so on. So as I was preparing, and I saw this theme in Tanya, I said, that's exactly the same thing that the Baal Tanya is saying. That's what the Alter Rebbe is saying so amazingly, brilliantly. He says, recognize that undesirable lusts and thoughts and doubts, they come from within a component of ourselves. Validate it, admit it, recognize it, acknowledge it. And recognize you may not have the power to uproot it. You may not ever become the person who's not tempted by food, or is not tempted by honor, or is not tempted by desire, who is not filled with doubts. You may never become that person. And you beat yourself up throughout your life about it, you won't accomplish anything other than feeling guilty for it. Confront it, acknowledge it, embrace it, and figure out how to use it for good. How to make sure it doesn't sabotage. That's the Beinoni, the struggle. Embrace, and now work around. The presence within us is not tragic or categorically bad. We can achieve perfection in mastering and controlling them. The concept of the Beinoni, who is in everyone's reach, everyone can aspire to it. The Beinoni is the hero of Tanya. It speaks to the Beinoni throughout the book. Chabad. We have a couple minutes left. Thank you for indulging me here. Other Hasidus focuses on the idea that God desires the heart. God desires the heart. Pray with passion. Somebody asked me before about Torah, learning Torah. Where does Torah fit in? Somebody asked me that? Zmir asked me that. But I said we would get to that. Other Hasidus revolves around the heart. I'm about to tell you something you may not know. And when I learned Tanya, I found it startling. Chabad Chassidus revolves not around the heart, but around the head. You might have thought Chassidus, by definition, wasn't what the Baal Shem was trying to do. Fervor, passion, enthusiasm, emotion, the heart. Comes along the Alter Rebbe and he says, God also desires the mind, and without the mind, the heart is useless. You have to have joy and enthusiasm, but you can't have emotion in a superficial way. jumping jacks and bouncing off the wall and enthusiasm and banging your head, but without upstairs having an understanding, you're missing something. So in chapter 13 of Tanya, he writes, understanding is the mother of fear and love of God. These are born of knowledge and profound contemplation of the greatness of God. You want Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem, love and fear of God? It doesn't come from jumping jacks. It doesn't even come from a L'chaim of vodka. You know what it comes from? Torah study. From knowledge. The Rebbe writes in Tanya, in some of the strongest language I've ever read, endorsing and obligating us in the study of Torah. The mind. You may not think this, it may not strike you right away, but it's all there black and white in Tanya. Chabad, in fact, stands for nothing to do with the heart. The acronym Chabad, as we know the movement and his introduction of his philosophy, is all about the head, it's not about the heart. The Ch of Chabad is Chachma, wisdom and insight. Intellectual insight, it provides the raw idea for Bina. The B of Chabad is Bina, which means understanding. It develops the idea from Chachma. Implications, ramifications. Chachma is the raw idea. Chachma, the Balatanya writes, Chachma is comprised of the words Koach Ma, the power of what's in it. It's information, but it's information rich with potential. Bina takes that raw information, it's understanding, it develops it. And then the Dalet is Da'as, knowledge, connection. It's taking information with insight and now connecting it to the person so that it penetrates, so that it's executed upon, so that it's applied, so that it's lasting. Structure of the book. It's broken into five different parts, the Tanya. First three parts were published originally as the Tanya in 1797, originally anonymously. The last two parts were added when it was published in 1814 after his death. Sefer Abeinonim, Shara Yichud Ve'amuna, Igeres HaTshuva, Igeres HaChor Kodesh, and the Kuntras Achron. Finally, just like our Torah has a written Torah and an oral Torah, just like our Torah, we have the Torah Shebichsav and the Torah Shebapeh, so Chassidus also has what it considers its Torah Shebichsav and its Torah Shebapeh. The Tanya is the written Torah, the Torah Shebichsav of Chassidus. What Chumash is to the Word of God, to Torah's Ha Nigla, the revealed Torah, Chassidim Chabad consider Tanya to be the written Torah, the Torah Shebichsav of Chassidus. Now, just like every Torah Shebichsav, the Chumash needs a Torah Shebapeh, it needs an oral tradition to accompany it, the same is true with Tanya. Rav Zusha of Annapolis, the Halakha Rav Zusha, who lived in the 18th century, a contemporary of the Baal Tanya, he has the greatest quote about the Tanya. He says, I wonder how he managed to put such a great and awesome God into such a small book. It's a brilliant, brilliant book. Now, I don't want to oversimplify. It doesn't read like a Tony Robbins book. It doesn't read like a Deepak Chopra, whatever these people's names books are. It has Kabbalah terminology that can be complicated. You have to be familiar. You have to have a dictionary of Kabbalah. It quotes extensively from all over Gemara, Medrash, Talmud, and so on. And there are sections of it which are very esoteric, which are very difficult. But if you fight your way through them, and if you study them, you will encounter parts that will resonate with such a deep part of who you are, they will literally transform you. And I want to make three suggestions of how to study Tanya in a way that will really move you. First is Rav Manitz Friedman, his brother. He has a series of, you can listen now on your iPhone, you could listen through podcasts, you could listen online. Once upon a time you bought these sleeves of cassette tapes. But Rav Manitz Friedman has his Tanya. You could listen, does a phenomenal job of explaining and inspiring and so on. There is the lessons in Tanya. I don't know, Kahoot publishes it, I know, but I don't know who wrote it. Do you know who wrote? Is it just the...
Jacobson.
Rabbi Jacobson?
No.
But what I have found the most, this is my Tanya, you see them all marked up. Only three volumes are out so far. This is Rabbi Steinsaltz's commentary on Tanya. And that's what's here on the left. Rabbi Steinsaltz. Rabbi Steinsaltz's commentary on Tanya is unbelievable, just like he is. If you look at the handouts I gave you, and I see we're not going to have time to really study, but these come from him. If you look on any of these pages, you'll see, for example, go to page 4. The bold line, that's Tanya. The paragraphs that follow, That's Rabbi Steinsaltz. For every 10 words of Tanya, Rabbi Steinsaltz writes 2 pages. That's why, by the way, these 3 volumes only go through chapter 37 of Tanya. He has it in Hebrew, and it's in Hebrew. He just completed. Rabbi Steinsaltz's commentary on Tanya is completed in Hebrew. The English translation, they only have these 3 volumes so far. So I highly, highly, highly recommend them. Rabbi Steinsaltz brings in such contemporary metaphors, such relevant ideas. It's been a joy to learn the Tanya with Rabbi Steinsaltz. I can't recommend it highly enough. All these ideas, in fact, many of the ideas that we shared tonight really come from him. Let me walk you through the handout, and then with that we will close. But what you have in the handout, we don't have time for. The first 2 pages are the introduction to Tanya. It's an English translation of Rav Schneir Zalman of Liadi's Introduction to All of Tanya. The 3rd page is a very controversial statement in Tanya, in which Rav Schneir Zalman of Liadi suggests that Jews have superior souls to non-Jews. The Rav, look at the bottom of page 3, Rabbi Soloveitchik. This is comes from a direct quote. In Cleveland, someone asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, "In Cleveland, I attended a class given by Lubavitcher Chassid de Balabatim. He was teaching Tanya. I certainly didn't know what he was talking about. I don't think he knew what he was talking about. He mentioned concepts, terms that he didn't know what they meant. I asked him about 1 or 2 concepts. He couldn't define them, but they were all listening, seeming interested. The Rav interrupted him, and the Rav says, this is exactly what they do. They have someone teach Chassidus Tanya about the hierarchy of souls. The soul of the Goy, the soul of the Behema come from the same origin. What's the Seichel? It's another question. The Rav rejected the possibility, and the Rav, by the way, knew Tanya practically by heart. If you think, that's another one of the great, I've spoken about this in the Shtibel Minyan at length, Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was the descendant of the Vilna Gaon, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe were dear friends. They were classmates in Berlin together in the university, and they were dear friends. Rabbi Soloveitchik went to Fabrengen of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Rabbi Soloveitchik, when he was living in Chaslovich, his father was the Rav of Chaslovich. It was a Misnagdisha rabbi that saved one of the Lubavitcher Rebbe's. And so, as an expression of gratitude, the Rav of Chaslovich was always a Misnagid. So Rabbi Soloveitchik's father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, was the Rav of Chaslovich. So Rabbi Soloveitchik's first teacher in Cheder was a Lubavitch Malamed. When his father found out that all he was learning was Tanya and no Mishnah, he pulled him out, and that's when Rabbi Soloveitchik never stepped foot in yeshiva again from a few years old. He learned at home only with his father. But from those early years, Rabbi Soloveitchik knew Tanya practically by heart and talked about its depth and came back to it. In fact, in the 3rd volume of Rav Schechter's intellectual biography of Rabbi Soloveitchik, he quotes some Yiddish speeches of the Rav referring to Tanya and referring to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Rav, one summer, the boys from YU on the summers would go up to Boston to learn with the Rav. So one summer, the Rav wanted to learn Tanya with them. And after 2 days, it didn't work. They rebelled, they wanted to go back to Gemara. And the Rav bemoaned publicly, "The boys are only interested what's in my head, they have no interest what's in my heart." Very interesting. So one of the great ironies of history is here you have Rabbi Soloveitchik, a descendant of the Vilna Gaon, of Brisk, of Volozhin, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the heir to Chassidus, to Lubavitch, to Chabad. So there's this controversial statement of the Tanya, hold on just a second. Then there's Rabbi Steinsaltz's interpretation of this statement. And did he really say that? That's pages 4, 5, and 6. Did the Bala Tanya really say that the Jewish soul is superior? Page 7 is another example. Kuzari also says that, yeah. Page 7 is another example I just quoted about Tanya here, where he talks about turning away from evil, doing good. It just, if you look, you'll see just the brilliance of the Tanya and of Rabbi Steinsaltz. Another example on page 8. In addition, the godly soul has 3 garments. Remember I was telling you about the 3 garments of the godly soul? That's page 8 and page 9, which are the 3 garments of the godly soul. So there are some examples. You can start to look and study it on your own. I highly recommend this version, any version of Tanya. You've been a great audience. Thank you very much.
Thank you.